My fellow Americans, I can hardly express the gratitude I feel toward you for re-electing me, Senator Bob Doomspeak, to represent you in the hallowed halls of our nation's capital. A lot of politicians like to pretend to be Washington outsiders, but I live on an island trash fortress and communicate with my constituents via messages tied to plague rats. I am so glad to once again have an opportunity to burrow myself like a tick into our nation's corridors of power and suck the blood and marrow from it until its husk collapses around my laughing corpse. My first order of business is to have my political opponent fed to a starving pig, and then to give everyone who voted against me a venereal disease and a shoddy lobotomy. I'll fulfill my campaign promise to bend God over his throne and sodomize him while setting fire to swimming pools full of human embryos. I can't wait to pull up my shirt sleeves and give this nation the anal fisting it's been screaming for in my dreams. I am Satan's loneliest abortion, and I have orgasms when I think of new moral degradations. We live in a divided nation, but I'm sure, if we pull together, we can fill Lake Michigan with human blood. But what about the working man? Read my lips. I will personally impregnate him with my toxic death seed, and that is not a metaphor. I believe children should be fed hallucinogenic drugs until their reality is a universe of screaming neurons. I believe crime should be fought with complete human extinction. Join hands with me, friends, and welcome this new American carnage. I am so glad to share this vision with you. And now, the Postculture Podcast. We didn't meet in any special sort of way, just one of the ways that people meet. My neighborhood coffee shop on a quiet Sunday morning, I'd come in for a bite to eat and to work on some personal projects. I noticed her right away, with her pale skin, her dark, well-groomed black hair. Her clothes were eccentrically old-fashioned, embroidery, frills. She was reading a book at the table, and the table next door was free. I didn't come in looking to find love, though I was certainly drawn to her. I let her be, snatching glances now and then, trying to see what she was reading, committing her unique features to the part of my memory that draws from such things. It was her scent, though, that ensnared me. Not perfume or shampoo or some sort of other artificial covering, but an aroma that seemed to emanate from her, as if it were baked into her. It's hard to describe, something like dust and rose water, forgotten hallways, playrooms sealed up after the children have grown. Upon it first reaching my mind, I began to fill with this sense of nostalgia for things I couldn't quite remember. I felt like if I let this moment pass, let this person walk out of my life without some attempt at contact, I would regret it forever. Speaking to her was awkward at first. I didn't want to interrupt her, to poison my first impression with rudeness. But I couldn't catch her eye. So, as it turned out, it was a passing customer on their way to the bathroom that was my saving grace. They bonked her table as they passed, causing her to look up, and her eyes met mine. And she's held the stare with me for an uncomfortably long time. I had to say something or look away, so I took a breath, and that scent, it hit me again. So I asked her what she was reading. She showed me, without speaking. It was an old Dick and Jane book, children's literature. It was one of her little quirks, I would find. I stammered out a few pleasantries, not getting any response, feeling my heart sink a bit, but that nothing would come of this. That's when she finally spoke.
I'm Talkie-Tina, and I don't like you.
My feeble pickup attempts stopped like they'd been hit with a brick. In that silent moment, she slid a piece of paper over to me as she gathered her things to get ready to leave. I opened it, and it was her phone number.
I'm Talkie-Tina, and you'll be sorry.
I held that note until she was gone, and my food order had been called a couple of times before I even noticed. The waiter ended up having to come tap me on the shoulder, tell me to go pick it up. And that's how I ended up dating Talkie Tina, the haunted doll. She was amazing. She was a malignant force of evil who channeled the darkest impulses of children. But she was between gigs when I met her, so we had a lot of time to get to know each other. On her first date, I took her to a film noir festival at a local art house cinema. And we held hands while watching Barbara Stanwyck look sultry.
I'm Talkie-Tina, and I'm going to kill you.
That is so hot, Tina. Those first few months were magic, as new love so often is. Walking through the park on a carpet of fallen autumn leaves, trading parts of our history back and forth in these endless looping conversations. We exchanged little gifts. An antique tortoiseshell hairbrush for her, a bag full of rat skulls for me.
I'm Talkie-Tina, and you had better be nice to me.
Oh, baby, you know I will. We take these long drives through the city, taking each other to our favorite places, the rock gardens, this out-of-the-way art gallery, the city dump, that daycare that closed down after those kids disappeared. We had this romantic weekend at a cabin out on the coast, watching the rain pour and the waves crash against the rocks as we sipped Pinot Noir by the fireplace, and I felt happier than I ever had in my life.
I'm Talkie-Tina. And I don't know, what do you want for dinner?
Oh, I'm thinking Szechuan. Relationships are these nebulous things. Two people with their own stories and perspectives in their heads, trying to match them together, like trying to get two translucent images to align. I loved Tina. I still do. Deep down, but I couldn't see the world the way she saw it, as a 2.5 foot tall, talking doll hell-bent on vengeance. I know my inability to get that empathy to come out for me was a problem. It led to strife. She grew bored with me, I think. She disengaged when we talked, and I'd find myself just talking rather than conversing. She barely registered when I'd buy her flowers or those little Moleskine notebooks she liked, when before she would have enthusiastically promised to kill me. And finally, after weeks of drawn-out tension, she finally dropped the bomb on me.
I'm Talkie Tina, and I think we should see other people.
I was devastated. I tried to say I didn't understand, that I thought things had been going so well, but I knew that wasn't true, even as the sobbing words came out of my mouth. I wanted to plead, to beg, to offer anything just to keep us together. But it was like crying for a shattered mirror to mend. I left her apartment that night, drained and aimless, wandering the city for hours like the dull ache in my heart was a cramp to be walked off. Wanting her to love me and having her love me were two different things, and in that aftermath, I couldn't reconcile them. I'm not too proud of the weeks that followed. I kept finding myself in her neighborhood, walking past her apartment. Soon I stopped pretending that I had some other reason to be in the area, and I just started showing up as a matter of routine. I would find myself looking at her window, circling the block to see it over and over, without just standing there on the sidewalk. Every now and then I would see her little silhouette in the blinds and feel closer to her. I called and texted incessantly, my daily mood hinging on what response I elicited, usually, and with increasing frequency, no response whatsoever. It wasn't long before I was digging through her trash, an open junk mail and coffee grounds mostly, and I felt like an idiot. Pretty much right away. And that's when the fever started to break. My obsession, though, hadn't gone without notice, of course, and when she texted me, I was ready to approach it with a little more humility, maturity.
I'm Talkie Tina, and we need to set some boundaries.
I haven't spoken to Tina in a few years now. She took a gig in Florida, down to the Keys. Some abusive stepdad. She drove to the brink of madness. She hooked up with some guy from Key West. I even unfriended her on Facebook when her feed just became mostly their vacation photos and image macros of sunsets captioned with Deepak Chopra quotes. I think our relationship was a confluence of time and place. It couldn't be recreated. We're different people now. Likely we just bore each other. But some nights, when I'm alone, I imagine her next to me, whispering in my ear.
I'm Talkie Tina, and true love is forever.
Black rat, someday I'll find your trail.
Charlotte. Charlotte. Lawyers breed by exploding into clouds of spores, Charlotte. Everybody knows that. Charlotte, stop talking about how homeless people have families. It's making it difficult for me to enjoy my salted caramel mocha. Charlotte. Charlotte, your pledge of eternal devotion to Adolf Hitler was extremely problematic, Charlotte. Charlotte. Gambling away the mortgage money on the commodities market is the most responsible thing a man can do, Charlotte. Charlotte, new rule. Everyone deserves to feel bad about themselves. Steve, you drink too much. Charlotte, you too. Refusing to feed me Reese's peanut butter snacks until I am sick is gaslighting, Charlotte. Charlotte, I think our dog knows we use cocaine, Charlotte. Charlotte. Charlotte, intestines are just tubes. They sell tubes at Home Hardware, Charlotte. Charlotte, the real racism is against gamers, Charlotte. A wizard told me that in a dream. Don't dispute me. Charlotte, stealing dogs is completely ethical. Don't argue with me about this, Charlotte. Charlotte, Charlotte, I've decided I'm going to die and I want you to film it. Charlotte, stop crying and hold this camera. Charlotte, 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 Charlotte. Our conquest is complete, and the refuge is ours. This shall be our chronicle. We are 30 strong-willed and well-armed men with balls of steel and the soil of this land in our veins. The keepers of this refuge fled their stations like cowards when our might was shown, and now we are its masters. Already the forces of government oppression make their presence known, a single patrol car sitting by the access road, waving away those who thought today would be a normal day. Let them pass, I say. Let them come forth and see the flowering of something great. Once this refuge was a place where those who could not educate themselves would come to learn about egrets, and where these birds would be sheltered from the forces of the free market by a government too cowardly and wasteful to let nature take its course. Now this earth will once again be under the stewardship of men, and likely soon others will follow our lead, and our national anthem shall be played by the dropping of shackles. We shall make this refuge a symbol, one we shall defend with our blood to the last man, just as we would defend the proud flag of our nation from the unwashed hordes. And songs shall be sung of this righteous stand, sung first by Jimmy, who was wise enough to bring a guitar, but then later by the self-taught children patriots of the next generation. These first few days have been marked with glory. The forces of government oppression don't come near, wary as they are of our strength. Soon these peons of anti-liberty shall realize that we are the true inheritors of the Founding Fathers' vision, and join us as brothers in arms. But it is early still, and instead they cordon off the roads and watch us while the jackals of the press try to get a look at what a real patriot is. Or so we assume. It's still just the one patrol car and the access road, onlookers likely kept far from sight. For now, we drink our beer and grill our burgers, and mock those who wish to possess the refuge again. We've used our time well, building up fortifications, partitioning out the space of the refuge into areas for sleep, areas to plan, areas to train and prepare for the assault we all know is coming. We're tense, collectively a wire strung taut, and we vibrate with anticipation. There are no leaders here. When each man is an individual, there's no need for a commander for a just cause. Jimmy has already been writing songs to commemorate our exploits, a tuneless noodling that will soon breed symphonies. We are poised, and we are ready. It's been 7 days now with no response from the forces of government oppression. The patrol car is still sitting there blocking the access road, but no one has driven by recently to be turned away. I'm not even sure there's an officer still in the car. Gary, with binoculars, says he hasn't seen one. Still, we grill our burgers. We drink our beer. We found out Jimmy can't really play the guitar, and listening to him try to learn was getting on everyone's nerves. So we gave the guitar over to Dale, used to be in that Godsmack cover band. We're gonna let him sort out the anthems for a while. We had some time to become more familiar with this slice of God's kingdom. It's not much out here. We're free of the poisons of modern liberal culture, which saps men of their drive and purpose, but without anything to replace it. Marshland and egret shit, mostly. Not much to be said about the egrets either. They taste like shit. Get really pissy when you try to jerk off near their nests. I'm not a freak or nothing, but, you know, trying to jerk off on a bird's nest. But fuck, you know, I mean, where's this fella supposed to get any privacy? I should probably just edit this part out. We've been here for a month now with no contact with the outside world. No cell service or internet, either. Phone lines are dead. The police car has been sitting there empty for weeks. Nothing of use inside it. Radio doesn't work. Keys are gone. We all dared Richie to take a shit in the back seat, and when he did, we closed the doors and locked him in. We all had a good laugh watching him trapped in there with a pile of his own shit, banging on the windows, swearing at us. Then we all thought it would be pretty funny to leave him there for a few hours, so we did. Then we got the idea to piss all over the car and leave him there overnight, so we did that. Anyway, he's been in there for 3 days. Been drinking his own piss out of one of his shoes, looking at us like a starving dog every time we take a gander at him. Letting him starve out there is kind of like one of those little group in jokes, where no one wants to be the first one to ruin it by getting all serious about things. A couple of the guys went off for what they said was a beer run. As a group, I think we all knew they were trying to ditch the cause, but that slim chance they would actually return with beer stayed our hand towards retribution for this treason. They took one of the trucks, gave Ricky the finger as they passed him, headed down the road. About 12 hours later, after dark, one of the pair, a guy named Big Mike, came back on foot, covered in blood, clothes torn, shaking like he was hypothermic. A couple of us were still up and we saw him coming. Dale, though, was on guard duty out front and he didn't see him coming. Freaked out and plugged him in the neck with a round from his .38. We watched Big Mike fall to the dirt and start gasping, blood spurting out of him like a tiny water feature. In a minute or two, he stopped breathing and just lay there in a puddle of himself. It was too dark to do anything about it, so we just left him there overnight. Next morning, the door to the police cruiser was open. Ricky was gone. Big Mike's body was also gone, dragged off into the sagebrush, further out than any of us wanted to follow. Jimmy's pregnant. I don't know who got him pregnant, or even how he got pregnant. The boy has definitely got a dick. We've all seen it. At first we thought he was just getting fat. It should be weird since we ran out of burgers and beer, been living on egret
meat and shrubs for a while now, and we're all pretty sure he was hiding a stash of Snickers or something somewhere. But then the damn thing started kicking, and we all got a little spooked. He looks a few months along now, and frankly, none of us want to talk about it. It's just easier to accept it than to try to think through the implications. We keep him well-fed and well-clothed, give him the best padded cot, and at most we have some quiet bets going on as to which hole we think the damn critter is going to crawl out of. Jimmy himself never really even talks about it. Mix of shame and also relief that he no longer has to work. There's been a howling in the sagebrush lately. Normally we take pot shots at sounds in the night, see if we hit something. But this is different. It's a cruel, hungry howling. Bitter, vengeful. The morning after we first heard it, we found a coyote crucified and eviscerated on the hood of Clyde's truck, bleeding all over his Confederate flag paint job. We've all thought of running, grabbing our keys and loading up our trucks and bolting for it. We hear the noises. We saw what happened to Big Mike. But in force, I think we could do it. So what keeps us here? A few of the guys have started talking a little crazy, paying a lot of attention to Jimmy, fat as a spring hog and looking ready to burst forth with whatever freakish new form of life he's growing in there. A new hope. Life finds a way. They're too scared to break out, so they think this plump miracle is their ticket to a new society. That howling is getting worse. And I've been finding tracks of a barefoot man in the brush just outside the light of our evening fires, watching us in the dark. I did it, but I did it alone, and I have never been more afraid. I'm sitting in my truck, the gas tank empty. All around me is dark and endless. The refuge is only 40 minutes from the closest town, but I devoured asphalt for hours, and I saw no light but my own headlights and their reflection in the eyes of creatures watching me as I passed. I should turn off the dome light so I can't be seen, but the thought of being in total darkness has me feeling like that time my older brother tossed me off of our paddle boat when I was 8 into the middle of a lake, and then rowed off to teach me how to swim. He paddled back when he saw my head go under, not come back up. Pulled me out just as I started to black out. Black out. God, there aren't even stars in the sky. Jimmy went into labor, is how it happened. Everyone gathered around to settle bets or pay homage to the first member of our more perfect union. I didn't want to see it. Didn't want to hear his angry grunting as the little monster made its way through whatever passage it was going to attempt. I grabbed my rifle, what little food I could pillage, and I headed for my truck. I siphoned gas out of Clyde's rig and made sure I had a full tank, and got ready to speed off. As my headlights clicked on, I saw a face ahead of me in the darkness. It was Ricky, or something like him. He seemed taller and thinner than even the emaciated wreck we'd left trapped in a car for 3 days as a joke. His limbs elongated like he'd been stretched out. I held up my rifle, but he just stared at it. His hair was a wild, tangled mess, and there was blood on his mouth. He stood between me and the access road. Just as he seemed ready to move toward me, I heard a sound from the compound. A child's cry drowned out by the screams of almost 30 men. Ricky seemed drawn to it. In that moment of distraction, I gunned it, swung hard, and I got around him. And he screeched like an angry bird and slashed at my truck, swiping at the door, but not able to get a grip before I hit the road and sped off, leaving the refuge to flourish without me. It's still a few hours to daylight, and I have to move down the road on foot as soon as I'm able to see. I know I'm hundreds of miles from Ricky or anyone else at the refuge at this point, but Big Mike and his friend came down this way. Big Mike came back alone within hours, bloody. I have no friends here, and I've never felt more alone. I tried to sing some of the old songs I memorized as a kid driving around in the back of my mom's Chevy on our way to run errands. I stopped when I was sure I could hear someone singing along in the distance, not an echo, but a voice that was more mocking. The sun will rise soon. I have faith in that, at least. If asleep, I'll wake up, and it'll be rising. If I wake up.
Greetings, science knots! It's time for another glimpse into the wonders of the universe with that wizard of physics, the Professor, and his young assistant, Jimmy!
Well, I've got exciting news for you today, Jimmy.
What is it, Professor?
Using baking soda, vinegar, scotch tape, and an electric current, I've opened a portal into an alternate reality.
Golly gee, Professor, what does it mean?
It means I can kill whoever I want in there, and the law can't do a thing.
Does it have any other applications?
You mean other than gorging my soul on consequence-free depravity? Well, unlimited energy, I guess.
How would it do that?
A billion slaves, Jimmy! An entire alternate timeline full of forced labor!
That seems immoral.
Science is about to fuck your morality in the ass, Jimmy. Get used to it. I've got a surprise for you, Jimmy.
Did you bring my dog back to life?
Even better. No, Jimmy, I have successfully managed to clone you.
Gee willikers. Hello, Proto-Jimmy. Oh, golly, it's like looking into a mirror. Wow, my very own clone, someone just like me. We'll be the best friends ever. So, new Jimmy, do you want to play kickball? No. Oh, well, that's all right. We can find something else to do. What do you feel like doing? I'd like to attach a car battery to a monkey's testicles and see what happens. I don't think I'd like to do that. Well, do you like surprises? Oh, yeah, I love surprises. Then prepare for a big one, as I have also cloned myself. Hello, Proto-Jimmy. Alpha-Jimmy. Professor? This is getting a little weird. Then prepare for even further astonishment, as I have also cloned myself. Greetings, brethren. Professor? Please, this is making me a little uncomfortable. He is questioning the purpose of our existence. He is a danger to us. We must destroy Proto Jimmy. Yeah, guys. Let's cut his brain out. Yeah, and play kickball with it. Oh, man, you guys are assholes.
Well, Jimmy, it looks like the end has come.
The end of the show?
No, Jimmy, I mean the end of my grotesque life on this rotting planet. I'm dying, Jimmy.
Oh, golly, I'm so sorry, Professor.
Don't be sorry, Jimmy. Death is merely a new adventure. The last undertaking. The last undiscovered plane of existence that each one of us must explore for themselves.
Wow, that's really brave of you, Professor.
Nope, it's brave of you. You see, I've decided I'm not going anywhere while there's still an atom of this universe I haven't split. So I've decided to strip your body of organs and brain fluid in order to forestall my demise for a few more miserable years.
What?
I laced your big league chew with sedatives. You'll be unconscious in a moment.
But...
Tell us what the other side looks like if you get a chance, Jimmy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Post Culture Podcast, Death Comes for Dr. Acula. The piece Charlotte was written by Twitter user Dr. Veritas. You can follow him at DocTorVeritas on Twitter.com. Music was provided by Fourth Shift. You can find them at fourthshift.bandcamp.com. Sewing Machines at sewingmachines, standard spelling, .bandcamp.com. Dr. Quandary at drquandary.com. And Psychic Mold at psychicmold.bandcamp.com. Additional music provided by Memphis Mini, Pan Ron, Bix Beidebeck, and Harry Null. Remember, love is real, but hell is waiting.